Good morning. Welcome to, let's see, where are we? It's a challenge to get here, isn't it? Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, and where we try to welcome everyone every Sunday morning, no matter your ethnicity, your gender preference, your theological beliefs, you are welcome here. I always say that you should come more than one Sunday if you're new to either us or Unitarian Universalism, because things are different every Sunday. Sometimes our services are led by an outside person, sometimes they're led by one of our lay members, and sometimes they're led by moi, Reverend Sandy. Sandy is fine. These then are the opening words. They were written by Carl Seberg. Let there be joy in our coming together. Let there be truth heard in the words we speak and the songs we sing. Let there be help and healing for our disharmony and despair. Let there be silence for the voice within us and beyond us. Let there be joy in our coming together. And Mary, would you light the chalice, please? Be ye lamps unto yourselves. Be your own confidence. Hold to the truth within yourselves as to the only lamp. So the Buddhist chalice. It's a poem by Mary Oliver I would like to share with you, titled, The Buddha's Last Instruction. Make of yourself a light, said the Buddha before he died. I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness, to send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two sala trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields. Around him, the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs disattached in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills like a million flowers on fire. Clearly, I'm not needed, yet I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly, beneath the branches, he raised his head. He looked into the faces of the frightened crowd. There must be as many myths about Buddhism out there as there are about Unitarian Universalism. I mean, what with poems like that one, or the story for all ages, and all the riddles in Zen Buddhism. What I want to do this morning is take a somewhat playful look at Buddhism, give you some idea of what meditation is all about, and I want to wake you up, because that's what Buddhism is all about, at least Zen Buddhism. Some of the words that I hope you take away with you today when you leave this building and go about your daily and weekly tasks are these words: mindfulness, awake, loving kindness, bodhisattva. To be Buddhist, according to Western beliefs, is to go with the flow. Be cool about it. Now, of course, I'm being somewhat facetious here, mocking that popular notion of what Buddhism is. In an issue of Shambhala Sun, a bi-monthly Buddhist publication, Daniel Mennecker had a lot of fun with some of the popular misconceptions about Buddhism. So you want to be a Buddhist, he begins with the use hyphenated. Who doesn't? It's easy and also fun, especially if, like me and most Americans who enjoy relaxing on the deck and talking about Buddhism, you know very little about it. I mean, the kind of people who, when you get a little ticked off at them for breaking the gears of the bicycle they borrowed from you yesterday, say, "Would you please try to be a little more Buddhist about this?" And any, I think this will include all of us who are now dealing with, depending on what direction you came from this morning, the getting here and the extra little roundabout to do. I had to keep thinking this morning, of course it didn't help that my car was way on the Near East Side, to be a little more Buddhist about this. The first thing you have to do, says Daniel Mennecker, is renounce desire. But since you want to renounce desire, that's desire in and end of itself. So renounce the desire to renounce desire, and you can do whatever you please. Like trying to get in good with your old girlfriend, Tony, plus become an ipso facto Buddhist at the same time. Sweet, no? And the real Buddhists can't object because they are enjoined to universal kindness and have to keep on grinning that real Buddhist grin. The next thing you have to do is decide on whether you're going to say Buddhist, 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 Buddhist. Of course, Mennecker says that for his money, the first sounds low rent, Buddhist, kind of ghost-like, Casper the Ghost. And the last, Buddhist, sounds a little floral. And there are some people who do say Buddhist. And also could be heard as Buddhist. So the second it is, Buddhist, rhymes with wood, so I'm still not doing it right, Buddhist. And even though in order to say it that way, you have to purse your lips in a strange manner, but okay, you're well on your way. The next thing you have to do is know some terminology, or at least pretend to know it, so that you can use it when the conversational waters get heavy. Well, I'm not going to give you a lot of in the way of terminology this morning. I'll mostly be using words that you're familiar with, but I may give new meaning to some of them. So now seems like the right time to do a little Buddhism with you. And in true Buddhist fashion, we will calmly accept the gift of this time, right now, and do our best to be present to it. And the word for that, of course, is mindfulness. At any rate, here we are, and I thought, in keeping with the spirit of Buddhist philosophy, that we would simply meditate for the next 20 to 30 minutes. And I'm just kidding. Although I do have a couple more meditation times thrown in there, so be patient. And the lack of the congregational response time is on purpose, partly because this is a meditative service, partly because it's the middle of August and we can experiment, and partly because we won't have time after all that meditation. I'm not an expert in meditation techniques, nor am I an expert on Buddhism in general, but I do know enough about it to believe that there is much in it that is important, much that can be useful to us in our everyday lives, much that should not be dismissed as weird or exotic or other. One of the aspects of Unitarian Universalism that I particularly value is our respect for other religious traditions. I learn from other faith traditions, and I discover tools that helped me on my own religious journey. And here are some of the things that I have gained from a knowledge of Buddhism and from meditation. Once I said that, and I said medication. But no, I mean meditation. Clarity. Not constant clarity, but occasional glimpses of clarity. Loving kindness. Compassion towards all sentient beings, leading to, I hope, a greater understanding of the interdependent web. A stronger call to social justice action. And most importantly, for me at least, mindfulness. Mindfulness is the aware, balanced acceptance of present experience. It is opening to or receiving the present moment, pleasant or unpleasant, just as it is, without either clinging to it or rejecting it. Sometime I'll possibly do a Sunday on the hindrances about the Buddhist outlook on life and the wisdom of the dark emotions. And I would also like to do a Sunday on how Buddhism promotes social justice work. I've been trying to remember how and or when my interest in Buddhism began. I realized that simply by virtue of being a Unitarian Universalist, my interest in and awareness of Buddhism was made possible. First, because of Max Gabler, now Minister Emeritus at First Unitarian Society here in Madison, and then because of Michael Schuller, the current minister at First Unitarian. I had the privilege of hearing several excellent sermons by both Max and Michael on the subject of Buddhism. And I was also, as some of you know, I had the privilege of working on the staff with Michael, who was then a practicing Buddhist, and I assume he still is. Then there was my oh-so-brief relationship with the Dalai Lama in the early 90s. Some of you have heard this story. I went to hear the Dalai Lama speak, and he was at the field house. Is it still called the field house? On campus, and I got separated from the people I was with when I was going through the parking lot. And so I'm trying to find them, and I started to cross one of the lanes in the parking lot, and a car almost hit me. And it came to a screeching halt, and of course I'm ready to use some swear words. And the back window rolled down, and it was the Dalai Lama in the back seat. And he did this. And I, fine, run over me, it's okay. I haven't achieved nirvana yet, but you can still run for me. Okay, so we didn't exactly have a relationship, but we did have that real life encounter, and obviously it made a lasting impression on me. And I was so intrigued with this man that I spent three whole days with him in, I think, 2009, well, me and a couple hundred other people at the Alliance Center. Which was just amazing. And somewhere in the course of that three-day workshop, I became a bodhisattva, which is a Buddhist nun. I did not know I was taking the vows to become a bodhisattva, but I was. So here I am. And bodhisattvas, their whole purpose in life is supposed to be loving kindness and compassion and outreach and social justice. What kind of life philosophy, belief, creed led to the kind of peacefulness and equanimity that radiates from the Dalai Lama? What could produce such a beautiful, smiling face? My first semester in seminary in the fall of 1994, I signed up for not one, but two classes on Buddhism, only I didn't know one was going to be a class on Buddhism. I'll get back to that in a minute. But the one that said Introduction to Buddhism was taught by a monk from Sri Lanka. His Buddhism was out here somewhere. Mine was here. And I really didn't know what happened that whole semester. I got something out of it, some appreciation of Buddhism, but He was way, way above our heads. Sylvia Boorstein, whom some of you may know, in fact, I borrowed the title of one of her books, It's Easier Than You Think, for my reflections this morning. Boorstein says, in a brief section titled Demystifying Spirituality, I don't want to get into defining the word spirituality today, but Boorstein's point, I think, is that spirituality is not necessarily what we think it is or what we have been culturally conditioned to think it is. The spiritual includes the ordinary. Boorstein says, being a meditator and developing equanimity do not mean becoming weird. Practicing Buddhism means having some very useful tools for everyday living in your toolbox. Most of us manage, sort of muddle through life somehow or other, or at least it seems that way. Buddhism gives us the means to manage more gracefully. Buddhism helps us to wake up to the truth, which can indeed set us free and bring us happiness, as well as bring us peace and compel us to take compassionate action in the world. Buddhism is about paying attention to our lives. What the Buddha taught about how to find wisdom and happiness in this life was simple. Boorstein puts it this way. Essentially, he taught that it doesn't make sense to upset ourselves about what is beyond our control. We don't get a choice about what hand we are dealt in this life. The only choice we have is our attitude about the cards we hold and the finesse with which we play our hand. First, though, we need the map for living this life, or the maps. The maps for the journey to wisdom and happiness. And the most important map on the road to happiness. And I don't mean surfacey, cheery, that smiling face happiness. I mean a deep sense of peace and compassion. The most important map on this road is the one known as the Four Noble Truths. Before we get to that, I would like to share a poem with you by Lao Tzu, a Chinese Taoist master who lived 500 years before Jesus was born. Lao Tzu writes, empty your mind of all thoughts. Let your heart be at peace. Watch the turmoil of beings, but contemplate their return. Each separate being in the universe returns to the common source. Returning to the source is serenity. If you don't realize the source, you stumble in confusion and sorrow. When you realize where you come from, you naturally become more tolerant, disinterested, amused, kind-hearted as a grandmother, dignified as a king, immersed in the wonder of the Tao. You can deal with whatever life brings you. And when death comes, you are ready. One of the enigmas of Buddhism to me is that meditation, especially for those who have not grown up with it, and I suspect that includes everybody in this room. Meditation can cause you to fall asleep. But the outcome of meditation is to wake up, to be awake and aware. The Buddha was asked, are you a god?
No.
Are you an angel?
No.
Are you a saint?
No.
Are you a king?
No.
Then what are you?
I am awake.
Just join me in a few more moments of meditation. The Four Noble Truths in a nutshell and rapidly. The first one, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Life is difficult. Life is mysterious. Life is unpredictable. Life is scary. Being alive is very dangerous, and every moment of life is very precious. All relationships end in loss. Loss is painful. There. We have named, if not all, then most of the elephants in the living room. And even after acknowledging them, it is possible to be happy. Remember, it's that deep, contented, rootedness, happy. Because pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. The second noble truth. Clinging is suffering. I'm in the midst of moving. I know a lot about clinging and not being able to let go. Suffering is what happens when we struggle with whatever our life experience is, rather than accepting and opening to our experience with wise and compassionate response. Suffering is an optional extra, says Sylvia Borstein. Everything changes. Pain and loss are inevitable, but our response to them is not inevitable. We can struggle and resist, or we can stop clinging, accept, and learn. This does not mean that we become indifferent to life. This does not mean that we cease to be passionate about life. The trick is to learn to live passionately without clinging, without attachment, without wanting. Craving anything is suffering. Borstein tells a story about her son's mother-in-law, who manages gracefully when things are unpleasant. She is the only person I have ever driven with on Los Angeles freeways, with cars whizzing in and out of lanes arbitrarily in snarly, congested, smoggy traffic, tie-ups, who says with genuine awe, wow, look at all these people going places. I try when I'm driving and I want to, you know, I want to say something really nasty to some drivers. I try to stop and think, when someone's cut me off or something, well, maybe their mother just died. We don't know. The third noble truth, which is terrific good news, according to Borstein, and the good news isn't that if you meditate long enough, you will have no pain. The terrific good news is that we don't have to suffer. See a pattern here. Our minds are so conditioned, we are so stuck in our psychological and spiritual mind habits that we have a difficult time getting to peace of mind. But it is possible, and that's what meditation is for, to cultivate a mind that's so wide and open, it can be passionate and awake and responsive and involved and care about things and not struggle. Borstein was once asked by some of her affluent students who thought that Buddhism seemed joyless, do Buddhists have birthday parties? And she had a friend whom people called the first patriarch of Berkeley, and he died of cancer in his 40s. He had everything, career, wife, children. He wrote a letter to his family and friends, a letter he wanted them to read after he died. In it he said, "I would have wanted more, but I never wanted other." The fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, which is actually another map. And the Buddha offers that to us. Borstein, though, has two other names for it. The Eightfold Circle or the Eightfold Dot. She likes the circle description because you can enter at any point. The religious journey, the spiritual quest, whatever this is that we're all on, the journey of life, it's always the same circle. But a path analogy implies that you need to begin at the beginning and then you're going to proceed in a linear manner, sound Western, and until you get to the end, then you get off the path. The Buddha said you'd know you were on the right path or the circle if you saw any of the eight special markers or signposts. We'll get to those in just a moment. It doesn't really matter because each one has all the others within it, so it doesn't matter which one of the eight folds you come in on. It's all connected. And even labeling this map a circle creates the idea of a here and a there, but some of you will remember that Gertrude Stein told us there is no there there. So if we're following the Buddhist road to happiness, when we finally achieve some degree of clarity, mindfulness, awakening, then we get to be more here than we ever were before. Before I tell you about the eight markers on the path to happiness, and they're very brief, I'm going to have you meditate again for a few minutes. Now, perhaps I should have done this at the beginning, but I saved it till the end for a reason. Don't let the word meditate throw you. Try to approach it with that open, empty mind. That won't happen, of course. All sorts of random, irrelevant, seemingly inappropriate, perhaps even perverse thoughts will enter your minds. Grocery lists or to-do lists may pop up in your head, and that's fine. Simply recognize them for what they are and send that thought right out of your head. The same thing with sounds. I got a little hung up on that bird. No. Bird sound out of mind. Monkey mind is what we call this. It's a reference to all that stuff that floats around in your head and gets in the way of clear, compassionate, wide open, peaceful mind. For me, I often return to a favorite spot on the Pacific coast in Mendocino County to bring me back to a place of peace and quietness. Now, all the meditating I've done over the years, I can say truthfully, I've rarely gotten to, I don't know if I've ever gotten to an empty mind, but it's gotten less cluttered. There are so many things you can bring yourself back to. Picnic point, flowers in your yard. But if you need something a little more cerebral to meditate on, try thinking about no hate. Try to breathe in compassion and loving kindness, peace, boundless goodwill, and breathe out the hatred and the grudges and the fears and the prejudices and the judgments. The first time I got serious, well, I was going to say I got serious about meditating, but that's not true. The first time I ever meditated was in Joanna Macy's class. How many of you ever heard of Joanna Macy? Wow. She's quite a famous American Buddhist. She wrote World as Lover, World as Self. She's quintessential Californian. She has done a lot of work with the Tibetans and they're being exiled. She went to Chernobyl and did a lot of work with people there, always as a meditator. I don't know how I ever got into her class. You had to write a little blurb about why you wanted to take this class. Someone had given me a hint that if I mentioned I'd been active in a group called Beyond War, which Joanna Macy helped form and start in California, I could probably get in. That must have been it. So the first class were freshmen, or what passes for freshmen, in seminary. And she said she was going to begin the class with meditating. Okay, fine. I had a vague idea of what that was. 20 minutes. She didn't tell us. But we meditated for 20 minutes. Or I should say we sat there. Some of us fell asleep, including me. Her response was, maybe you're not getting enough rest. She had no sympathy for any pathetic excuses. So, try breathing in, breathing out. Try not to think of things like, when is she going to ring the chime? Just try to empty your mind and find some peace and contentment. How long do you think you meditated?
2 minutes.
First time was just short of 2 minutes. The second time was 2.5 minutes. The third time was 3 minutes. Not much time out of your life. Okay, speaking of time, we don't have enough time to go into any detail about the 8 markers, so I'll mention each one and just elaborate briefly. First one, right understanding. Nothing is forever, change is inevitable, everything changes, nothing is permanent. Got that one? Okay. Number two, right aspiration, which is behaving in a way that stretches the limits of conditioned response. If you want to live in a way that is loving and generous and fearless, then you have to practice overcoming any tendency to be angry or greedy or confused. Think of life as a terrific gym, G-Y-M, with ongoing opportunities to practice. Buddhists call this cultivating non-hatred, non-greed, non-delusion. Third, right action, which means don't cause pain. Every religion or ethical system has a code of ethics and a list of do's and don'ts. Buddhism is no exception. Buddhists express it this way: every single act we do has the potential of causing pain, and every single thing we do has consequences that echo way beyond what we can imagine. I wish our leaders would grasp this. Anyway, right action doesn't mean we shouldn't act. It means we should act carefully. Everything matters. Four, right speech. Be completely honest and helpful. Don't gossip. This may sound simple, but just try it. Try giving up making comments about people when they're not present. Borstein says that very high-level right speech requires awareness of intention in all communication, not just gossip. It can be done by being present, by being exquisitely present, and by observing the 60-second rule, which is also a Quaker exercise. Pause 60 seconds before answering a question. I have a 24-hour rule. I'm not answering your emails for 24 hours if they are things that I need to put in the back burner. Number five, right livelihood. Organizing your financial support so that it is non-abusive, non-exploitive, and non-harming. Sylvia Borstein admits that this is harder to do now than in the time of the Buddha. Right livelihood also includes your internal attitudes about work, as well as what you actually do as work. Number six, right effort. This would have been my mother's favorite had she been a Buddhist practitioner, because it can roughly be translated as, don't worry, be happy, her mantra. The Buddhists say it more eloquently, every mind moment conditions the next. Every mind moment conditions the next. Grumbling gets the mind bogged down in the weariness of its own story. Happiness pulls it back out and gets it going again. Borstein tells the story of one of her teachers who always ended their sessions with, "Remember, Sylvia, be happy." "For a long time," says Borstein, "I thought it was the casual 'have a good day' that we all use. And after a while, I realized it was an instruction." Number 7, right concentration, the ability to let the attention become absorbed in one single thing. In other words, paying attention to the moment, to your feelings, to that balance, that exquisite balance that it is possible to maintain by being present in each moment. Buddhists do not multitask. Number 8, right mindfulness. It's right concentration that leads to the last of the markers. Right mindfulness, balanced acceptance of present experience. So that's it. See how simple it is? It is, though, easier than you might think. Mindfulness, as I said at the beginning, is opening to or receiving the present moment, pleasant or unpleasant, just as it is, without clinging to it or rejecting it or judging it. Think of it as freedom. Every moment of clarity you have is a moment of freedom, and you get that clarity by being so in the moment. In that moment, that the tensions of judging or preferring, rejecting or desiring are not there. As Borstein says, we have only moments. Right now is the only time we ever have. I'll end my reflections with a contemporary Buddhist gratitude prayer, a very short one. I am thankful that thus far today I have not had any unkind thoughts or said any harsh words or done anything that I might regret. However, now I need to get out of bed, and so things may become more difficult.